yeah, you can't argue with results. You know, back in 20, he got appointed in September 2012 or something like that. And when the investors, when he was presented to the investors, you know, telco, very traditional, risk averse industry, and then John Legere walks out on stage, they must have shit themselves.
Hello and welcome to another telecoms.com podcast. I'm joined as ever by Jamie and his best friend and Ian. just to remind you that if you're listening to this on SoundCloud or on iTunes, you can watch it on the site or on Facebook or on YouTube. And if you're watching it, you can listen to it on the aforementioned places. This week...
Oh, I like the use of the word aforementioned there.
Yeah? I said aforementioned, you said aforementioned. I don't know where the emphasis is now.
No.
I'm not going to use it anymore. You've ruined it for me.
A bit like that bloke's name who's about to come up.
Oh, at the end. Okay. Yeah, we'll work on that one. We're going to start off by talking about Europe. We've written a bunch of stories about Europe this week, and it's obviously quite topical. We'll try not to go too crazy on Brexit, eh? Too much of a tangent. And, of course, there'll be the matter of whether Pierre's allowed to be a colleague of ours after the end of March. But anyway, I'm joking.
Yeah, he might get deported.
Quite.
I've been here long enough.
And then we're going to inevitably move on to the topic that no telecoms.com podcast would be complete without, which is Huawei, because there's always something going on with them, and actually them in Europe. And then we're going to chat a little bit about the O-RAN Alliance and a little bit about Jamie's other mate, apart from his phone, John Ledger, or Legere. Anyway, whatever it is. So there we go. Okay, so what was the first thing? Oh, yeah, Europe. So I wrote a story this week that was a rumour. Basically, the government's put through a bit of legislation that says, look, if we don't get some kind of Brexit deal, then we can't hold European operators, we can't force them to not charge wholesale roaming fees, as the long and short of it. And then from that, we're going to not oblige UK operators to keep their to charge no premium. I not have a roaming charge, because that would be unfair on them. If they're paying higher wholesale, why shouldn't they pass that on to their customers? I thought that was all perfectly reasonable. Obviously, you know, it got into the mainstream and everyone was like, you know, right now we're in a period where we're getting close to Brexit big day. We haven't got a deal yet and we're getting a lot of apocalyptic stuff. I wrote at the end of my piece that we're going to run out of Mars bars, McDonald's and Magnums.
That could be bad.
Yeah.
So skinny Britain coming up.
Well, this was my point. I said plus side, if we do manage to get to Europe, we can look great on the beach.
The Brexit diet, yeah.
Yeah, the Brexit diet. Unfortunately, according to this latest scare, we're not going to be able to afford to put it up on Facebook because we're paying £1 million per megabyte of data. So I thought that was interesting. But obviously, yeah, the mainstream press went with that as yet another sort of apocalyptic story about what a disaster it's all going to be. And you know, laying my political cards on the table, I don't think it will be. I think we'll get through. Obviously, there'll be some aggro, but I think it's being quite overplayed.
What, roaming?
No. The consequences of no-deal Brexit. But yes, Ian, I was chatting to you about this. You know, I think... Do you agree that I've sort of related it accurately so far, but you still don't think that that's likely to actually happen, yeah?
Yeah, I'm probably not as extreme as you are, I suppose, in the consequences of the coming out of the EU. I don't think it's all scaremongering, but I do think this is scaremongering, actually. This is those pesky Ramoners saying how the world's going to end and they're not going to be able to use data services when they go to Europe anymore.
That's what we deserve for being such racist swine.
Who knows what could happen? But and certainly they've got the opportunity, I guess, to reinstitute roaming charges if this legislation allows them to do that. But
indeed,
I think there's two reasons why they wouldn't. One is I'm not sure the end of roaming's been. I mean, they've made it out to be this charge they needed to apply to recoup sort of, you know, costs, and because they were being so generous in other areas, that was one opportunity for them to make some money.
Yeah,
and therefore
that was their moaning. That was their big moan. Was wrapping it up.
I don't recall seeing anybody's financial earnings falling off a cliff as a result of the end of roaming. And actually, one thing it has done is given people the freedom to use data services overseas.
Yeah.
And which is an incentive to take a data package, you know, if you weren't sort of subscribing before. And a lot of usage is overseas. A lot of usage when I probably use it more on the continent when I travel than data connectivity than I do here, because you tend to rely, I think, on knowing Wi-Fi where you are and you use Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
And whereas that whole mapping service, trying to get around, is something that's really valuable.
It certainly is.
So I think that's one reason why they wouldn't want to do it. I just think it's been really good for customers, and people have. It's one example of something they've done where they've actually been delighted customers, and operators don't often do that. And I also think you've got these challenges in the market, people like Three in particular, mm-hmm. who I think moved to get rid of roaming charges anyway before any legislation had come
in. Well, that's
going very much on that slope.
Yeah, that roaming thing's always been one of their USPs,
think,
isn't it?
You know, unless they all do it in concert, in which case it looks smacks of kind of cartel-like activity, and it's going to attract other issues. I don't see that it would be done. So I think it's all
for that.
Scaremongering, actually.
I actually do agree that it's unlikely they'd do it. It was fair play to them. It was Bix. Via the PR agency Babel that flagged up the story to me, and I put the quote from the Bix guy in it, who, you know, that's one of their things, is talking about roaming, and he said, yeah, it wouldn't make much business sense. So, as you say, if they don't act unilaterally, then the people who hike their prices are just going to see churn away from them, aren't they?
Yeah.
For anyone for whom this is a deal breaker.
There's a lot of people who travel and use their phones. It's quite a big number of people.
Well, yeah, like in a couple of weeks when we're in Barcelona, we'll be spanking it.
Yep.
By that I mean using lots of data, in case the sensors.
Yeah, but so none of you guys pay roaming charges in Spain, do you?
No. Not now.
But after Brexit.
Yeah.
Who knows?
So yeah, with Three, that's been going on for years then.
Yeah, they started to do it a long
time
ago.
Yeah, and in fact, Three still vowed that they're not going to show. They're the only ones who have apparently gone on the record and said, there's no way, it doesn't matter what happens, even if we saw Britain off the end of Europe and ship it into the middle of the Atlantic, we're still going to...
Well,
speaking for myself,
if EE brought roaming charges in, and we all of us in this room do a lot of travelling and use our phones, I imagine, a lot overseas... And I've had in the past, before this whole legislation came in, I remember getting quite big charges when I hadn't bothered to go and get a data
bill shock.
Package. Yeah. If EE decided they were going to go back to those days and Three wasn't, I'd be very tempted to move to Three.
Quite.
But they also have like free roaming in, you know, the US. Like they had free roaming in Uruguay when I was there.
Yeah, Three is making more of a thing of it than any of the other UK operators, as far as I'm concerned. The other point I would make is, let's say they justified raising their prices by saying the wholesale price has gone up. As I wrote in my piece, if I was them, I'd name and shame the Continental wholesale, because the chances are they're part of a larger group.
Yeah,
you know, like Telefonica or Orange or Deutsche Telekom.
Yeah.
So if suddenly you go over there and you know someone's taking a piss, then I'd just name and shame them.
Doesn't really matter if they don't have UK operations, though, does it?
Well, like I said, the chances are they might be part of a larger group.
Vodafone, DT don't have UK operations, neither do Orange.
Well, Telefonica and Vodafone and Three all have European operations. Three's already said it's not.
Three's already said,
them.
But
so
I mean,
it's only
if,
EE, really,
no, but if it was DT who said that who were hiking up, Orange or Iliad or any of the massive. There's more. You know, there's 160 telcos on the Europe in Europe.
Agreed. Yeah. It would be much more effective for those who have UK operations than those who don't.
But there's only like two or three of
them. But either way, as a piece of sort of aggressive sort of PR, I still, even if it's just to try and deflect attention away from themselves, if I was in their position, I'd go, well, don't look at me. You know, SFR have just hoiked their wholesale prices up. What do you want a bloke to do?
Yeah.
Sort of thing. So that was, and I was just quite enjoyed writing about Brexit this time of year.
Mm.
It's all, well, I mean, this period in history. Yeah, although unfortunately no one's bitten. I guess I could have been more sort of opinionated and tried to sort of troll people into responding, but I didn't manage to get anyone to sort of bite on that one, but that's fair enough.
You can still do it.
I'll still give it a go.
Tweet it out a bit.
What do you reckon then? Do you think no deal Brexit? Is that going to be a disaster then? Is that what you think?
I don't think it would be like we all go off and live in log cabins and start eating each other. But I don't think it's going to be very good.
Fair enough. What about you, Jamie? No deal Brexit?
I think any Brexit situation is probably going to be not great for the first 12 months, and then it'll probably go back to business as usual.
Sort itself out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we can all loosely agree on that. There we are. Look at me trying to engineer some kind of Brexit dispute, and we just naturally agree with each other. It's because we're reasonable, sensible people. So other Europe stuff that's been going on. In fact, I'm going to cover one or two other things that I wrote about Europe, and then I'm going to hand it over. There's just some other interesting things going on to do with the sort of European bureaucracy. So there's one, there's this thing called Article 13, which has got sort of internet freedom people up in arms. It's one of these things where people say it's going to break the internet. That's sort of hyperbole that gets thrown around. So Article 13 is about protecting copyright.
Yeah.
And Europe wants to get a lot more proactive about stopping people uploading copyright protected material, such that they want to impose things that are called generically called upload filters. So in other words, you're not even able to upload something unless you've got some proof that you've paid a license on that. You know, and lots of people say that fundamentally breaks the internet, because the internet's all about sort of quite spontaneous sharing. Yeah, and there's another one, Article 11, to do with hyperlinks and all that sort of thing. If suddenly, you know, you can't stick anything up, or you can't link to anything without there being some kind of consideration, it's going to clog up the whole process, it seems likely to me. And they're quite unpopular. But Europe's done its usual thing of Article 13 has lots of resistance. Last month, there was a few dissenting countries in the European Council or Parliament. There's so many different little layers of bureaucracy. And then a month later, they've come up with some really sort of token tweak to it, so it looks like it's back on. So that's one thing that's interesting from an internet point of view. What was the other Europe one? Oh, yeah, I wrote a story about them patting the big US internet companies on the back for being good censors. Yeah. So Europe's also insisting that Facebook, Twitter, etc., take down anything that's reported as hate speech.
Yeah.
Now, again, you could think, well, Scott, how could you have a problem with that? No one's in favour of hate speech. But, of course, the problem lies in how you define it and who determines what it is and all that sort of thing. And in my view, it's excessively heavy-handed, such that anything that someone considers to be hate speech, there's not even strict parameters as to what it is. So I could be saying, I hate that T-shirt. Is that hate speech? Which I don't, by the way. I think it's an excellent T-shirt. but, you know, is that hate speech? So when you have loose parameters, you're always going to get people abusing it. And especially as the whole process relies on reporting, you're going to get malicious reporters, people reporting each other because they don't like each other, rather than because they think a hate crime has been committed.
T-shirtism, is it?
Well, exactly. You know, this T-shirt? This T-shirt's got an angry monster on it. Oh, it's pretty hateful, isn't it?
Mm.
What have you got? You've got a guitar? Could be misinterpreted, maybe. So anyway, so those are my Europe things, but I'm not going to bang on about them too long, because Jamie just wrote an excellent piece today, really put his back into it, about the sort of broader sort of geopolitical stuff that's going on to do, I suppose, principally with Huawei, and we will get into more on Huawei after that. But, you know, what is Europe going to do about all this stuff where everyone's really twitchy about letting Chinese companies involved in, especially the 5G infrastructure? So I won't steal your thunder, Jamie. Why don't you tell us more about that piece?
Well, it's more just an overarching trend that you've seen over the last sort of couple of weeks. And it ties back into a lot of what you've been writing about with Article 13 and censorship, is that you've got more of a heavy-handed, top-down trickle effect on regulation and rules across the block. So, I mean, the basic idea of, or from my understanding of Europe, is that you have the European Commission that does sort of quite broad-level scene-setting rules at the top level, and then the more specific regulations and legislations for each of the nations are applied at local level, but feed off this sort of greater regulation.
Yeah.
And, you know, to get any fundamental changes to any rules or regulation in the European Union, you have to have agreement from all 28 states, which is part of the reason why Brussels is such a slow-moving beast.
And also quite a lot of stuff gets done just extra, you know, it just gets done. The European Commission just says this is the new deal.
Yeah, but
not everything gets voted on.
This is what I see as a big, big conflict area over the next sort of couple of months, is that Europe is reportedly rewriting rules, such as there's a 2016 cybersecurity rule that's been put in place, where they're redrafting the security precautions to effectively, although they haven't targeted specific countries, effectively bar China from participating in any form of critical infrastructure. In, you know, I mean, that applies to various different parts of society, but for our case, it's going to be communications infrastructure, so 5G primarily, but then also data centers, 4G, all that sort of thing moving forward, which is deemed
most bits of sort of like cloud related tech. Yeah, you know, it's all going to overlap, isn't it?
Yeah. So, but the big clash area that I see is that while you've got the overarching European overseers trying to ban Chinese companies, and you know, Huawei is the tip of the spear, from getting involved in the 5G bonanza.
Yeah.
You've got companies like, or you've got countries like the UK, and admittedly we're only going to be in Europe for the next 6 weeks, Germany, and other ones that I can't recall off the top of my head at the moment, who are drafting legislation to heighten security parameters but allow Chinese companies to participate and contribute to national infrastructure. Now for me, this is a huge clash, and this comes back to, and it's very similar to the federal versus state argument over in the US, is that you've got Germany, the biggest net contributor to financially to the European Union, saying they want to do this, and a few other countries that want to keep Huawei involved and ZTE involved in the infrastructure mix. But you've got the European Union completely undermining and contradicting their domestic stance. So for me this it questions the legitimacy of sovereign nations in Europe, and starts, and for the cynical people and the Eurosceptics, it does fuel the argument of the United States of Europe.
Yeah, well, as a card-carrying Eurosceptic myself, I will say that is a fundamental problem, and it's designed in. It's not like, let's say, so you got the United States, which is 50 states, but let's say up until, you know, 20 years ago, all those 50 states had been completely independent. If you suddenly threw them together, it would obviously be messy, and obviously European states have been around for millennia. So that's the really tricky bit. I mean, they've always said when the euro came along that this is a bit of a tangent. Sorry, I won't indulge myself for too long.
No, but it ties into the overall theme. Yeah.
The fiscal union without political union is dodgy at best. If you want people to follow the same fiscal policies, i.e.,
monetary.
Financial policies, you've got to have a degree of political union, and you know, the real breaking point's ultimately going to be over money, because you're going to need to have big net contributors, big net beneficiaries, typically from the north to the south in terms of the flow of money. And sooner or later, German voters, if they feel they're handing up too much money to Greece or whatever, are going to start to rebel. And then what do you do then? So yes, tangent over on that one, but that completely overlaps with what you're saying.
It's the same thing that people in London say about Lancashire, though.
Right,
isn't it?
Well, yes, I think in terms of public sector, the southeast of England does subsidise the rest of the country.
I think you get the same thing in all countries, don't you?
Yeah,
and the whole kind of breakup of Spain thing is all about that, you know.
But I think the difference between
that is a tangent. Yeah.
Yeah, but the difference between that and the European argument is that you do have 28 sovereign states.
Yeah.
Who have the rights to govern their country in the way that they see fit, and part of that government is to ensure security standards, and you know, to protect the citizens from, you know, outside threats. So why should you know, the Brussels Brunch Brigade be allowed to dictate security to terms to a nation which they theoretically have no control over?
Indeed.
I mean that's the big thing, and
it's a core tension.
And I just think this is going to evolve into, if Europe are continuing to rewrite these security standards and attempt to ban Chinese companies, I just think it's going to evolve into a major conflict.
Yeah.
Because you can't have the European Union dictating terms to someone like Germany. When they contribute, I looked at it this afternoon, they contributed, I think in 2017, because I don't think the 2018 numbers are out yet, 19% of the actual sort of budget
for Europe,
of Europe. Yeah. So you can't have like that. the Germans were going, hold on a second. Mm-hmm. We don't want to do this, and there's other countries that don't want to do this. You can't tell us to do this. I think it could be a major, major conflict point between Europe and the individual states.
It could be, and yet another one. So, you know, other ones I've touched on, like the euro and other points. You know, we've got Italy. Italy's politically going a little bit weird at the moment. It'll be someone else's turn some other time. But this is, I agree with you, Jamie, this is another major front on all that, is making this call over what to do about them. Mm. We had Huawei writing or responding to a letter from the UK government.
Yeah.
This week, why don't you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, I don't know if there was a lot new in it, really.
But why are they corresponding with each other?
Well, the UK government is apparently, I mean, I think the thing is, a lot of government positions on this are still unclear. And I suspect there's lots of these kinds of discussions going on at government level. You know, the security agencies themselves, I think, are the ones who are really worried.
Right.
And that's probably the case in Germany, I suspect. But you've got German politicians like Angela Merkel, who doesn't think it's such a good idea because she can see...
Don't think what's a good idea?
Keeping
them
Huawei
out.
Because she obviously, you know, is talking to Timoteus Hertges at Deutsche Telekom, and he's saying, well, hang on a minute, we've already spent all this money. You know, they're one of the biggest suppliers.
I mean, DT,
you know, look
came
at all
up.
The problems it's going to cause.
Didn't they say a couple of months back that banning Huawei would set their 5G ambitions back 2 years or something like that?
Exactly. Well, and that's no different, I don't think, from... I mean, BT, which is taking Huawei equipment out of the core network, has said a similar thing. I don't think it's not said it's going to have a 2-year impact on 5G, but it's said it's a 2-year process to do that. It's quite a disruptive move to do that. And therefore, these operators are obviously... Nick Reed, you know, Vodafone CEO, was who you quoted in your story, Jamie. You know, he was going on about... how awkward it is to have to do something like that. You know, it's not just the financial cost of it. It's a really disruptive move.
I don't think he was that nice in the way he said it. Really, I think he said if you ban Huawei, he said it wouldn't just cause us problems.
Yeah, he said a complete ban would be a huge issue for the whole telco sector.
Oh, yeah,
but he also said even a core network ban would be a really disruptive thing and difficult to do. So that the operators themselves don't want to get rid of Huawei, clearly. And they're obviously lobbying people, the top politicians. I think the concern's coming from other parts of other bits of the authorities, basically. It's people like, what's his name, at MI6, who in a conference even said, I think this is really concerning that we're using Huawei.
And, yeah.
You know,
and who's whispering in his ear?
And security people in the States are often quoted saying similar things.
That's another angle of Jamie's, you know, larger blocks versus sovereign nations. So it's quite clear that allies of the US have all got the US whispering in their ear.
Yeah.
And so there's a further tension to throw into your European mix. Mm. So you've got Germany wanting to make its own mind up. You've got Germany getting pressure from one direction from Europe. You've got Germany getting pressure from another direction from the US.
Well, this is the thing. Apparently, one of the big German issues is, and you guys have probably written about this, that because the T-Mobile, you know, Sprint deal is supposed to be going through.
Right.
But still needs some kind of sign-offs. Yeah. They're under pressure to get rid of Huawei completely from any of their international networks because they... You know, because the US is on this sort of anti Huawei campaign at the moment, and there's a lobby group, isn't there, in the States that you probably get emails from as much as I do, Protect the US or something.
I've seen that
constantly sending out these how evil Huawei is. And
I had a dig around, and it's almost impossible to find out who is in charge and who's funding that group. Yeah. It's a very, very secretive group. So I've largely ignored what they're saying.
They're massively opposed to the whole T-Mobile Sprint thing anyway, aren't they? They're sort of...
They're big anti-China.
They go on about job things, but also
George Soros. It's always George Soros at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's got to be.
As soon as I saw that, I had to dig into what...
What's it called? Protect the US or something?
Something like that.
Really like emotive, you know?
Mothers for Safety or something like that.
But if you actually have a dig down, and I went into their accounting records as well, and because they don't have to because it's an MPO, any donation over $5,000 has to be filed with the SEC or whatever body it is. I can't remember where I went, but it's going to be like 6 months later. Yeah. So all the campaigning that they're doing at the moment is clearly being funded by someone because they're spending a lot of money on it. Yeah. But we won't find out for 6 months' time actually who, when the actual filings appear in public domain and in sort of like the administrative offices of the US.
Right.
So figuring out who is actually throwing money at this organization, no idea. But that's part of the reason I've ignored most of what they've said.
Yeah.
Because if I don't know who's saying it.
No.
So I don't want to give them any credibility because I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, this could be a direct line from. I mean, there's all this scandal about they don't know where all the Trump money is going from his inauguration fundraisers. You know,
yeah.
Might lead back to the White House. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, I do love it. I do love it when sometimes some people stand up and get all surprised that it turns out there's a bit of dodginess that goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Again, another tangent, but political lobbying has been perfectly legal and part of the system for decades. But it's totally corrupt.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're a political party and you're accepting tons of money from someone with a narrow vested interest, then you're being corrupted by them. There's no two ways about it. But somehow you call it lobbying and it's all right. It's just fundraising.
Anyway. Yeah. It's all right now because you have to... there's a lot of detailed records about who... all the meetings. It's actually a really interesting website. I can't remember the exact link of it, but I'll send it to Pierre and Pierre can put it up on a graphic on the video.
His editing that much more tedious for him.
Yeah, but you can go through every single representative in the European Union and you can click on the MEPs or guys like Juncker and all that, and it lists all of the lobbyists that he's had meetings with, the topics, and who the lobbyists are officially representing.
That's good.
So it's
for anyone
actually,
who could be bothered to do it.
I dare say there's a lot of conversation isn't put down.
List how much Juncker drinks every day.
But
he doesn't mind a drink, does old Jean-Claude?
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's lots of stories. I mean, it might be completely unfair. It might be a stitch-up. But there's lots of stories about him looking absolutely plastered. So back to the Huawei thing. So they wrote that letter.
Oh, yeah. They asked me that and I never answered it.
That's why. Yeah. We still got that. It's all right. We, that's what we do. We're meandering.
Yeah.
They
did have a good drinks day, though, didn't they, this week?
Yeah, well, we were chatting about that letter. Yeah. So Huawei had a little Chinese New Year. It's the Year of the Pig.
Mm-hmm.
Appropriately enough, we went and had a big feed afterwards. So it's the Year of the Pig, and we went along, and they rented out a bar, and that was nice. It's nice to chat to some Huawei people that we haven't met before.
Yeah.
And they were obviously curious to know what we thought of this, that, and the other, and the letter. So the letter they wrote back, just to, you know, to echo what you're saying, they weren't saying anything particularly new, but they were spelling out their position, which the long and short of it comes down to no one's ever proven that we've done anything wrong. We're not going to do anything wrong. There's nothing in Chinese law that says we've got to do anything wrong. So why don't you back off?
Yeah.
Is the long and short of it. And I think we all agree that...
I think they also talked about steps they were going to try and take to meet some of the government concerns, though, didn't they? Because these vulnerabilities were flagged.
Yeah, which is a slightly different issue, but yes.
Yeah,
they're going to spend more money.
Because I know a lot of the press focused on this wording that they come out with about how long it would take to fix these.
Two or three years or whatever.
Two to five.
Do you know what? I noticed the press covered that. I completely overlooked that when I wrote it up as an angle. Don't know who's right.
And then they said... they sort of. I think they'd already announced this financial sort of commitment.
I thought baked into that, specific
to the UK. I don't think.
Yeah, and I thought baked into that was a little bit of a. We're prepared to invest lots of money in the UK.
Yes. Well, he even brought it up at the drinks, didn't he? The guy talked about how much they're prepared to invest at the end of 2021 or 2022 or something, and what they'd spent over the last few years. So, yeah, there's clearly that, you know, keep us here because we're good for your economy and it's going to need all the help it can get after that post-Brexit disaster.
After you've run out of Maltesers.
That ties into a lot of what's going on in, some of what's going on in Europe as well. When you look at Poland, I mean, Poland looked like it's effectively going to ban the sort of Huawei after all this espionage scandal a couple of months ago. But I think, what was it someone said to us? Poland is their Eastern European headquarters, effectively.
Yeah.
And they employ 900 people there. So, you know, you ban Huawei from Poland, and all of a sudden you've got X amount of bit, hundred millions of dollars leaving the economy every single month, and 900 yeah. jobs plus
yeah.
all of the indirect jobs from having, you know, the thousands of agencies, the technology staff, the lobbyists that will be in the yeah. country purely because Huawei's there. So it could be. I mean, you ban Huawei, and that's a lot of money and a lot of jobs that are leaving the country with it.
And to expand it further back to China itself, I mean, one of the ways in which China has been able to ramp its international influence a lot is through sort of direct investment. And I'm not saying any of that investment is anything other than legit investment, but if suddenly as a country or even as a company like Huawei, you're investing a ton of money, that's going to bring about some political influence as well.
Yeah,
you know, money talks and all that. So yeah, all that interdependence is fascinating, and Europe does the same. You know, Europe likes to promote its own champions, and a lot of European policy is about sort of defending Europe economically, and all that sort of thing. So they're all at it.
Yeah,
I don't think there's any good guys or bad guys, but it still comes down to, and we've said it many times before on the podcast with Huawei, but it's probably worth saying again. And Jamie was making the point while we're at drinks with them about them being asked to disprove a negative. They're now just a proxy for the West versus China sort of economic, political, cultural fight. And if we've just decided without any overt proof that China's just basically dodgy, and we all agree that there's certain things that they've done in the past, like currency manipulation, degree of mercantilism, some past history, to what extent it's still prevalent, I couldn't possibly comment, but some past history of IP theft and that sort of thing. So, and then Trump has ramped it up such that, look, China's just dodgy, all right? I don't even need to go into the details. Just take my word for it. They're dodgy. We need to keep them at arm's length. And thus, every Chinese company is going to be a proxy for that. And so while we can send their letter, which I thought was a perfectly well-worded, well-reasoned yeah. letter, but at the end of the day, if the way it's received by a Western government is, yeah, all right, but you're still a bit dodgy, aren't you? Huawei's going to go, well, how can I answer that?
Yeah.
How can I counter that? So, yes.
Yeah, their only solution is to become not Chinese.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? I mean, I said it, I think, writing about that letter. I mean, the only solution for China is for a fundamental thawing in relations between the US and China. It might still happen. I mean, Trump's got some weird methods, but sometimes they can be effective. He certainly gets people's attention. You know, obviously nobody knows.
He seems to have surrounded himself with, but sometimes it's not Trump, is it? He seems to have surrounded himself with hawks who are even more aggressive than, I mean, all that whole sort of ZTE
yeah.
rescue deal that he apparently came in and obviously had a chat with, you know, the president of China yeah. and thought, well, hang on a minute, you know, this is a lot of jobs and I can sort of show that I'm capable of sort yeah. of, you know, doing things. And then a couple of senators were really like critical of him, weren't they?
Yeah, it's
like,
this is not your business to poke your nose into.
You know, he's gone soft. What's he doing?
So like, he might try and poke his nose into the Huawei CFO much bigger, thing in Canada.
There's kind of hawks with much sharper talons in the US, I think, than.
Well, like,
than
Trump. Some people are just quite rightly concerned with due process. You know, to what extent, you know, there's supposed to be all sorts of checks and balances on executive power in the States. To what extent can the president just swan in
yeah.
and mess with, you know, law enforcement agencies, with regulators, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There has to be some limit
yeah.
to what this guy can do. And if there isn't, then how can he claim any moral ascendancy over a more authoritarian structure like China when he's behaving in the same way? So there's all sorts of contradictions there. Yeah, but maybe they will sort it out. I think sometimes you've got to be a bit of a bull in a china shop. Granted, Trump is an especially crude and sometimes destructive one. But maybe you've got to, because you tried doing it the touchy-feely diplomatic way and people just ignore you. So you certainly got their attention. And Huawei will certainly be hoping that all this gets patched up so it can just carry on doing its thing. Cool. All right. What else is going on?
T-Mobile?
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, I was going to save that one until last, because one slight overlap with what we're talking about is O-RAN Alliance.
Yeah, could mention that quickly, I suppose.
Yeah, I'll open it up and then I'll ask you, because I think you've been sort of thinking of some follow-up stuff. So long and short of it is, my story at the start of the week is that Ericsson has joined this thing called O-RAN Alliance, which stands for Open RAN, RAN being Radio Access Network. Why is that a big deal? Because basically radio access network technology is pretty much closed. If you buy Ericsson RAN gear, you're kind of stuck with Ericsson because there's a bunch of proprietary technology in there. And that obviously leads to quite good margins for them, because then you have to stick with them for that whole life cycle of the product, of the infrastructure, the maintenance, the upgrades, all that sort of thing. And so an open one where you've got a much more generic chunks of technology within the radio access network is obviously, in a business sense, antagonistic to people like Ericsson and Huawei and Nokia and ZTE, where they're still allowed to operate.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit surprising that they joined. But then, you know, my initial thought was, well, you know, whenever these new things come up, even if it's not something you're happy about, it's better to be inside knowing what's going on.
Yeah.
So that was my thinking. But I know over at Light Reading, you've been sort of, you think maybe there's a little bit more to it than that. But I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yeah, I mean, well, I've got to be careful what I say.
Yeah. But,
I mean, Nokia was already a member. I think that's the first thing to say. So you already have one of the big kind of kit vendors that had been... The O-RAN Alliance kind of group evolved from two other groups.
Right.
And they've been working on these sort of more open specifications to try and replace some of the technology that's currently in the RAN that does make it closed.
Yeah.
And Nokia had got sort of involved with that at quite an early stage, apparently. And, you know, if you talk to people who know a lot more about this sort of thing than I do, like Gabe, for example, at Heavy Reading, Gabriel Brown, he sort of his view is that there is an opportunity there for big kit vendors, because you can work with partners and do specific, you know, you can address sort of very niche requirements customers might have
even
by working with radio specialists.
Yeah, I think a good example of that model, not necessarily in the RAN space, is Red Hat.
Yeah.
You know, their model is to work with open source software,
yeah,
but to polish it up so that it's carrier grade or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's where they add their value.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But having said that, I know a lot of people are going to be, and there are a lot of people who are quite skeptical about the big kit vendors sort of being involved with this stuff. Because as you say, it's, you know, the, if it works out in the way that companies like Mavenir want it to, and Mavenir is like a software vendor that sees a big opportunity to come along and be disruptive here.
Right.
Then what you'd have is a market where you could buy your kind of baseband equipment, which is the stuff that processes all the signals, from Ericsson, and then you could go and get your radios from a bunch of alternative vendors making sort of white boxes, which are just kind of cheap,
so much more commoditized,
off-the-shelf commoditized stuff. And at the moment, you have to get everything from the Ericsson system, basically. So, yeah, that's obviously bad news for Ericsson or you know, anybody else who's kind of got a business model based on that, because it's kind of potential loss of sales and. And therefore, I think some people are kind of a bit sceptical and have said, well, they've got involved because it's a bit like Nokia getting involved in TIP, you know, the Facebook-led telecom infra project, which also has some other big vendors in it. But people look at it and they go, well, they'd rather be on the inside than the outside, and they're not really going to try and move things forward.
No.
But at the end of the day, they can't be seen to be too resistant. So
no, well, there are. So, you know, I'm going to interpret what you're inferring there, that if once they're in there, they can, in some way, at the very least, not assist the process. But but if you were going to do that, and we're not saying we know they are, but it's a reasonable guess.
Well, I think people I've spoken to say that certainly Ericsson and Huawei have not been very proactive in the past and have tried to slow things down.
Right.
In other groups.
I see.
So that would be ETSI and the 3GPP, which are the two big kind of standards groups, where there was some pressure to try and put together open standards.
I see.
That they were quite sort of resistant to doing that, and as a consequence, that's why it sort of got moved outside those bodies and ended up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's kind of the background for this whole
thing.
That's
kind of
the
background. Because they just saw that it wasn't in their interest. Now the thing that's happened now, I guess, is it's become a really urgent requirement for some very, very big service providers. If you look at the membership list of the O-RAN Alliance, it's people like AT&T, Verizon, Deutsche Telekom.
Every
big operator in every part of the world is a member of this group. And if all your customers are saying to you, well, this is what we really want, we want the ability to be able to do this. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Then...
shocking.
Then you can't just ignore it. You've got to be seen to be, to be somewhat responsive.
Yeah, you can't just
that.
Stick your fingers in you your ears and go, I'm not playing.
Ears. Whether they really, you know, whether they really want, I mean, I talked to the CTO when they made the announcement, and Ericsson's kind of focus in this group doesn't really seem to be on these, I mean, the bit that's attracted a lot of interest of the O-RAN Alliance, which you were alluding to, is these X-RAN specifications, which are essentially an alternative to a standard called CPRI. And it's that interface between the baseband and the radios that has stopped you from introducing...
Because that's proprietary.
It's sort of implemented in proprietary ways.
Right, okay.
And the bit that Ericsson really seems to be interested in getting involved in the O-RAN Alliance is not really to do with that. And if you say to them, could these X-RAN specs become an alternative to CPRI in the future, they say no. Right. They're kind of very sort of, it's not going to displace CPRI. And it's going to be a real challenge anyway to try and get a more open RAN. It's not just about getting the technology interface there. It's,
yeah.
There isn't a white box equipment market at the moment. You know, there isn't the... You know, there's lots of hurdles to make that happen. You need systems integrators to stitch all this together in a network. It becomes very complicated. So there's lots of
which
other
would be
barriers.
One of the points at which the big kit vendors go, you see, that's why you need us, because we've got it all.
But I think that the Huawei, all the stuff that's going on with Huawei at the moment actually ties into this, interestingly.
Okay.
It's not obvious how it does. But if you look at the equipment
make
market,
it obvious.
You go back a few years, and there used to be five or six big kit vendors. People like Nortel, Alcatel-Lucent were around. You know, all these companies selling equipment, and the market's now consolidated down to, you know, three and a bit vendors. And that's made, this is one of the reasons why there's a kind of push to have more competition in that area, I think. And analysts I've talked to sort of agree with that perspective.
Three starting to get
and then
dangerously
if all of a sudden Huawei gets locked out of European markets, as we've just been discussing, and you end up with two.
Or like US right now.
It makes an open RAN and even more.
So no wonder AT&T and Verizon right there, because they've got a choice of two in the US basically, haven't they?
So that's a kind of sort of interesting backdrop, I think, to it, and why it's, you know, why it does kind of tie into what's going on in the sort of geopolitical front as well, I think.
Cool. Well, talking about US... we also have been chatting about John Legere, whatever he is. He's the main man at T-Mobile US. And Jamie, you were just writing about their quarterlies and you were musing on the effect of the man himself. Why don't you tell us a bit more about that?
I just think, you know, John Legere, he's just the... He's a really good businessman.
He's effective, isn't he?
I mean, you look at. Okay, yeah, he's wild-eyed. He's incredibly egotistical.
Very dodgy haircut.
Yeah, you know, and I personally think it's all done on purpose to really exaggerate that view. But yeah, you can't argue with results. You know, back in 20, he got appointed in September 2012 or something like that, and when he was presented to the investors, you know. Telco, very traditional, risk averse industry, and then John Legere walks out on stage. They must have shit themselves. And then, you know, a couple of months later, he announces the first Un-carrier move, and it was, and like I said a couple of days ago, it went against everything that everyone knew,
hence the name,
was right in the telco industry, and it dropped contracts. You know, and they must have gone, what on earth is this guy doing? But then, you know, 15, 16 Un-carrier moves later, 6 years later, he's taken full year revenues from 20 billion in 2012 to 44 billion by the end of 2018. I mean, this is an industry which has flatlined or seen marginal growth, or, you know, 2-3% growth year on year, and then consistent, and then very few other telcos have been able to consistently do 2-3% every single year and every single quarter. I mean, this guy has more than doubled revenues in 6 years. I mean, that is just, that's like the kind of growth that the bloody OTTs are used to.
And obviously that growth is reflected in their subscriber growth as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they've gone from something like 30 million to 80 million customers now. I mean, it's just astronomical what they've done. And, you know, and I think there's, with 5G on the horizon, you know, how long can you continue this momentum? If the status quo is maintained, not very long. But you've got 5G on the horizon. The layer 1, 2, 3 acquisition of 2017 is a really interesting one. You know, they would have taken them into the TV market. There's a lot of people have been assuming that the next Un-carrier move was going to be launching a TV streaming service.
Wasn't there a story about that recently?
Yeah, no. So it came out with the financials.
Okay.
So basically, T-Mobile, and do you know what? I think it's an incredibly smart move, and it's something that Deutsche Telekom do in the German market, and I'm a big fan of going into this type of model, is that they turned around and said, there is so many streaming services in the US. You know, you're scrapping over some premium contracts. Don't get me wrong, they charge more for these services in the US than we're used to paying in Europe. But the marketing cost to acquire customers just makes it a pretty unattractive business model. So they're going to move into the content aggregator sort of platform. They're going
to just stitch it all together.
Stitch it all together and allow and put a billing service on top. So T-Mobile can help you pay for your services, right. But you look at it all through a single window instead of having to various different.
And if they're
apps.
Really clever, they could do stuff that we've chatted about loads of times on the podcast of setting up a much more sort of dynamic micro billing type of thing.
Yeah.
Whereby if you think you're going to be in all weekend because it's January and it's pissing it down, you can binge, but that doesn't mean you've got to commit to some massive contract for the rest of your life.
I mean, I think the aggregator model is probably one of the most intelligent and logical ones for telcos to get involved with, because they've got this unbelievable relationship with the consumer. I think utilities have a brilliant relationship with the consumer because you have one single provider. You know, how many OTT providers have you got?
Three or four.
How many contracts have you got?
If you include like Amazon Prime and that sort of thing.
But I mean, how many telco contracts have you got? Sorry.
Oh right, just the one. Yeah.
So you've got a single stream of communication.
BT and EE. But yeah.
But you've got a single stream of communication, and you generally only carry on one device, so you've got a single point.
So you've got
of
natural
contact.
Hubs.
So yeah. The telcos have this brilliant relationship, and they're not particularly, creative, agile. They hate the fail fast model, even though everyone says they love it. That's not very. If you're going to go into a streaming service, is that the right equation to actually run a successful product?
Yeah.
Probably not. But that logical sort of risk averse business model is brilliant for the aggregator platform. You know, it's
right.
So I think all the right ingredients are there for the telcos to be a value add to the TV segment, as opposed to trying to steal business off the likes of Hulu and Disney when it launches and Netflix and Amazon, and there's just so many.
So in the States we've got an interesting dynamic set up. So it seems as likely, if anyone's going to do the aggregator one well, it'll be T-Mobile US, because they're quite good at disruption, as we've just been talking about. On the flip side, we've had AT&T just drop 10 zillion quid, or dollars, on Time Warner. And there's a bunch of things like HBO packaged into that. So they've got to go all in on their own platform. They can't become an aggregator when they've got to get some ROI on that massive...
I think they're going to regret
this. They can still aggregate those stuff, couldn't they?
They can still do aggregation,
but they've got to try and favour their own stuff if they're going to justify the purchase, haven't they?
Yeah, but
there's no reason they can't.
It's not really that different, though, is it? From because Deutsche Telekom will still go and get some sports rights or whatever, like BT does, but then it doesn't stop them from bundling in Netflix and Amazon Prime.
But that's not the same as owning the content producer, like owning HBO.
Yeah, they got it.
No, they're not. They haven't got all those costs of making stuff, I guess.
And I think they're going to I think this is going to be a massive, massive regret for them. And I personally, although they'd never say it, I think there's a few execs in house that are going, why did we do that? but in a few years' time, because it was bought at the time where everyone thought, all the telcos thought, oh, we can get into TV and we can disrupt this. And it was like BT Sport was going strong for content. All the telcos. It was the in thing to own content.
Quite.
And now it's not. It's not, and they just spun.
I never really understood that
AT&T
move. Really, I never.
No,
really
I didn't
it.
Totally. Other than just,
I mean, unless they thought that they could, because shows like Game of Thrones and everything are obviously world famous, and unless they thought they could sort of lock people into their own service with that,
and then all of a sudden everything
goes
open.
Then you've got regulatory issues, then, haven't you? So,
but the new trend is openness now.
Exactly.
Where you could, I mean, just one final thing on that is that I think, so I've been to ABC over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
So the difference was prior to, and this just illustrates the trend of telcos trying to get into content, prior to the AT&T acquisition, I remember going to IBC and you had all loads of telcos up on the stage, and they were talking about how they were going to sort of change the content world and all that, and just how they were going to disrupt it and make millions, and convergence would be a wonderful thing. The year after, I remember going there and just looking at the agenda and saying, wow, there's no telcos here.
Right.
There are some, you know, there are some services which, you know, the primarily media, and then are branching into other areas like Sky. Mm. But telcos, they're not here. And that for me was a change in attitude from the telcos, that they said, we're not going to try and own content, we're going to try and add value to the TV segment.
It's been, to be honest, thinking about the sort of major disruptions of the internet era. So I think a lot about it, a lot of it on the social side, because I think it's fascinating how different the public discussion environment we have as a result of the internet, especially look at things like Twitter. I've been watching a lot of interviews with the Twitter CEO, Jack Dorsey, recently. And the more I look at it, the more I think, God, you know, we just weren't ready for this. We've suddenly gone from the biggest crowd we were in being in a pub to being in front of the whole world every day on our phones all the time. It's a massive cultural change. And then another big cultural change is obviously consumption of content, where it used to be in the cinema or in front of TV. And now suddenly we can get hold of all this stuff. And that's probably why there's been so much, perhaps rash M&A to do with content. So, funnily enough, you look at Time Warner, so the most catastrophic M&A of all time was AOL, Time Warner and dot-com bubble. Now, they will have merged. Certainly the Time Warner part of it will have merged because they were worried about the internet, and AOL then was still quite a contemporary internet brand, so they wanted to merge old and new and somehow do something with it, and it just didn't work. And then we've got both those bits that didn't work. The AOL bits ended up at Verizon. Time Warner bits ended up at AT&T. That's a really good illustration of how the operator groups are still trying to come to terms with digital content.
I think now they've got a bit of a handle on it, but at the time of when AT&T acquisition of Time Warner went through, I think it was that point of desperation where they saw that money was in content, they saw that consumer behaviour was changing, and it was more geared around sort of video content on mobile, and I think it was a panic. It was a case of, we need to buy our way into this segment.
No, I completely agree.
But 2 years later, they're starting to realise, okay, how can we actually make money off content? Mm-hmm. And I think everyone's starting to realise that the aggregator model is perfectly parallel to telco, because it's a functional relationship between the consumer and a third party, which is essentially
telco is the conduit.
Yeah, but that's all what telco services are. If you go back, you know,
back what's the pipe analogy? Yeah.
What the telco's really good at? Connecting A with B. That is just fundamentally what they are, and that's what the aggregator model is. It's connecting A with B, That's where Google have made all their money through referrals and advertising. That's where Facebook has made all its money. You know, it's a way that telcos can get into that walled garden model, but not have to really, really disrupt themselves and put themselves out of their comfort zone into an OTT environment.
Cool. Well, I think we've done about an hour, and Pierre keeps threatening to knock the cameras over.
I didn't, just happened once.
So sorry if this last cutaway to me, I look a bit different.
No, Jimmy was talking, so don't worry about it.
But yes, cool. Okay, well, that's fascinating. Thanks a lot, guys, and thank you very much for listening. Make sure you join us for the next one.